A broadcast of the reading of the Richmond Times-Dispatch on the Virginia Voice is made possible due to the generous support of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Welcome to the reading of the Wednesday, April 17th, Richmond Times-Dispatch. I'm Alex Childress for the Virginia Voice. We'll have about 25 minutes of front page and local news, followed by about 25 minutes of news from the nation and world. After that, a half hour of editorials, columnists, and letters to the editor from the opinions pages, as well as other news as time allows. Our final half hour, we'll begin with the obituaries, and then whatever else we have time for. But before all that, the 3-day Richmond area forecast. Today, a high of 75 and an overnight low of 60. Cloudy with a shower. Tomorrow, a high of 83 and a low of 51. Partly sunny and warmer. Finally, on Friday, a high of 71 and an overnight low of 56, not as warm, with some sun. Your readers for today are Emmett K. Jennings and Simon Kelly.
Thank you, Alex. Good morning. Our first article from the front page of today's Richmond Times-Dispatch is titled, Kane Has Big Edge in Bank, Cowell Pulling Ahead in GOP Contest. This article is written by Michael Martz of the newspaper. U.S. Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat Virginia, has plenty of money and time as the field of Republican challengers narrows 2 months before the GOP Senate primary on June 18th. Kaine, seeking his third Senate term, has raised more than $13 million for his reelection campaign, including $2.5 million in the quarter that ended on March 31st, and had nearly $8.8 million in the bank, according to reports filed this week at the Federal Election Commission. Kaine is just very strong, said Larry Sabato, president of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia. Retired U.S. Navy Captain Hung Cowell appears to be pulling ahead in the Republican nominating contest that has narrowed from 8 to 5 candidates. Cowell, who lost a congressional race to Representative Jennifer Wexton, Democrat from the 10th, by 6 percentage points 2 years ago, has raised $2 million to challenge Kaine, including $811,511 in the last quarter. You can never rule out anything in a low turnout primary, but he is the front runner for the Republicans, Sabato said. Cowell had $571,261 in cash on hand at the end of March, about $200,000 more than Club for Growth executive Scott Parkinson, who's raised $841,133, including $180,000 in the last quarter, and had $371,950 in the bank. Parkinson is followed by Fairfax County lawyer Jonathan Emard, who has raised more than $776,000, including $341,600 in loans he's made to the campaign. Former Virginia Beach GOP Chairman Chuck Smith, a former candidate for state attorney general, has raised $509,949, including more than $100,000 in the last quarter, but had just $24,516 in cash on hand at the end of March. Eddie Garcia has raised almost $300,000, but had less than $17,000 in the bank at the end of the quarter. The outlook is much the same in congressional elections across Virginia, with incumbents staked to big fundraising advantages in most contests. An exception is in the 5th District, where Representative Bob Good, Republican of the 5th, is trying to hold off an aggressive challenge by newly elected state Senator John McGuire, Republican from Goochland. McGuire is getting a big boost from former President Donald Trump, whose campaign has taken aim at Good for endorsing endorsing Florida Governor Ron DeSantis early in the presidential primary campaign. Good endorsed Trump immediately after DeSantis dropped out of the presidential campaign earlier this year, but the House race already has featured face-to-face confrontations between the congressman, who is chairman of the House Freedom Caucus, and McGuire and Trump supporters in the district. "It'll get uglier, that's a firm prediction," said Sabato, who lives in the district in Charlottesville. The FEC reports show Good with a fundraising lead of $307,616 for the quarter, $860,322 for the cycle, and $427,342 in the bank. McGuire's campaign committee raised $290,326 for the quarter, $502,747 for the cycle, and had $351,812 in the bank. McGuire said he's outpacing Good after including money raised through a leadership political action committee and joint fundraising committee. Through the three committees, his campaign says it has raised a total of $325,087 in the quarter and $560,925 in the cycle. Other incumbents have clear financial advantage in contested races. Representative Rob Whitman, Republican from the 1st, raised $415,274 in the quarter and more than $1.7 million in the cycle. Whitman, seeking his 9th full term after winning a special election in 2007, had almost $1.6 million in cash on hand at the end of March. In contrast, two Democratic challengers trail Whitman badly. Herb Jones, who lost to Whitman 2 years ago, raised $45,796 in the quarter and $144,230 in the cycle. He reported a cash balance of $267,799 at the end of March. Leslie Mehta, a former civil rights lawyer who formally launched her campaign in early January, raised $129,966 in the quarter and $135,261 for the cycle. Mehta reported $76,290 in cash, $76,298 in cash on hand at the end of March. Representative Jennifer Kiggins, Republican from the Senate, also has a commanding financial advantage, having raised $3 million, with almost $1.8 million in the bank. In contrast, Democrat Missy Cotter-Smassel has raised $509,535 and had $299,075 in hand, and Democrat Jake Denton has raised $210,215 with $127,931 in the bank. That's a big gap, Sabato said. Two of the most competitive congressional races are unfolding in Northern Virginia district with no returning incumbent. In the 7th, anchored in eastern Prince William County and the Fredericksburg area, Representative Abigail Spanberger, Democrat from the 7th, is running for governor next year instead of re-election to the House of Representatives. In the 10th, rooted in Loudoun County, Representative Jennifer Wexton, Democrat of the 10th, is retiring because of serious health concerns. The campaigns in the 7th feature 7 Democrats after one dropped out and 6 Republicans after 4 candidates withdrew. The Democratic field includes 2 Prince William supervisors, a sitting member of the House of Delegates, and a former member of the House, as well as candidate with a national profile, Eugene Vindman, whose twin brother, Alexander, gave testimony against Trump in the former president's 1st impeachment trial. Eugene Vindman, like his brother, served in the White House for the National Security Council and as deputy legal advisor. Also was involved in allegations that Trump had tried to tie USA to Ukraine in exchange for information to use in his 2020 campaign against Democrat Joe Biden, who won the presidency. Vindman, who already is a target for National Republicans, has a wide lead in fundraising. He raised more than $107 million in the quarter, almost $3.8 million in the cycle, and reported more than $1.8 million in the bank at the end of March. He's got a ton of money because he's a national fundraiser, Sabato said. However, he cautioned that Vindman faces formidable opposition from candidates with experience in elected office that he lacks. That's a strong group of candidates, Sabato said. Andrea Bailey, supervisor of Prince William's Potomac District, has $188,000 in the bank just 7 weeks after launching her campaign, in which she raised $408,497. Margaret Angela Franklin, supervisor for the Woodbridge District, reported $140,795 in the bank after raising $118,452 in the quarter and $241,346 in the cycle. Former Delegate Elizabeth Guzman, Democrat from Prince William, raised $161,390 in the quarter and $204,979 in the cycle, with $147,800 cash on hand. Delegate Brianna Sewell, Democrat from Prince William, raised $71,370 in the quarter and $172,724 overall, with $55,357 in the bank at the end of March. On the Republican side, former Green Beret Derek Anderson appears to have the advantage in fundraising and name recognition after finishing a surprise second in the 7th District GOP primary 2 years ago. Anderson, a native of Spotsylvania County, has picked up high-profile endorsements, including that of House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, and has raised a total of $888,595, with $581,000 in the bank. His closest GOP rival, former Navy SEAL combat veteran Cameron Hamilton, has raised $499,810 in the cycle and had $175,539 in the bank at the end of March. The Democratic field is even bigger in the 10th with 12 candidates, including former House Speaker Eileen Filler Corn, Democrat Fairfax, and 5 current members of the General Assembly. Delegate Dan Helmer, Democrat Fairfax, leads in fundraising with more than $1.1 million and $815,219 in the bank, while Filler Corn has raised almost $760,000 and had $434,591 in cash on hand. Crystal Call, a former Department of Defense official, has raised $930,000, including $552,500 in loans she made to the campaign, and had $607,793 in hand at the end of March. State Senator Suha Subramaniam, Democrat from Loudoun, who previously served in the House, has raised $679,183 and had $574,613 in the bank. That field also includes Senator Jennifer Boysko, Democrat Fairfax, Delegate David Reed, Democrat Loudoun, Delegate Michelle Maldonado, Democrat Prince William, and former Secretary of Education Atif Corney. Among the 4 GOP candidates in the 10th, Mike Clancy, a technology executive in Eastern Loudoun who ran for the nomination 2 years ago, leads in fundraising. He's raised $347,160 for the cycle, included $250,000 he lent the campaign, and had $240,674 in the bank at the end of March. Alicia Andrews, who lost to Wexton by 13 percentage points in 2020 and later served as Deputy Secretary under Governor Glenn Youngkin, has raised $106,494 and had $115,835 in cash on hand. This story from page 1 of today's Richmond Times-Dispatch, written by Michael Martz of the newspaper. It has the title, Kane Has Big Edge in Bank, Cowell Pulling Ahead in the GOP Contest. Simon?
Thank you, Emmett. The next story from today's front page, artists assist families facing homelessness. event celebrates how art can turn house into a home. The story written by Chelsea Jackson of the Times-Dispatch. Hanging art in your home is a great way to express your tastes and interests. Housing Families First, a non-profit organization that assists families facing homelessness, is celebrating how art can turn a house into a home. Their signature event, The Art of Housing, will make artwork from Richmond artists such as Michael Broth, Emily Herr, Hamilton Glass, and more, available for auction to help families facing homelessness. Housing Families First, located in Henrico's East End, gives families facing homelessness the opportunity to build a legacy for their families by providing a path to a permanent home. A permanent home is that starting point for all the other things you want to do in life. We do that through responding to crisis and helping people move into communities, and we've also added a youth housing program, said Beth Van Turnbull, Housing Families First's executive director. The organization's Hilliard House is a short-term emergency shelter that houses up to 40 children and adults who are on their way to a permanent home but need a safe and supportive space in between. The nonprofit's other core programs are the Building Neighbors Rapid Rehousing Program and Bringing Families Home, a partnership program with local school districts. When the people that they are working with are able to find a home, move in, sign a lease, and are able to put their kids' art on the refrigerator or put up a family picture, that is the moment the house becomes a home, Van Turnbull said. That is the moment they're like, okay, this is really going to be my home, because people don't trust that when they've been in transition, she said. The Art of Housing will be hosted at the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts at 200 North Arthur Ashe Boulevard in the Marble Hall on Thursday from 6 to 9 p.m. The event will include food, drinks, music, and a silent auction featuring donated artwork from local artists. The artists and pieces selected for the Art of Housing auction were curated by artist and muralist Broth, known as The Night Owl, and Elizabeth Dolan Wright, founder of the Commonwealth Public Art Fund. Having Michael and Elizabeth, who are so influential in the public art space, connecting home, community, and everybody else's place in it, has been amazing, said Van Turnbull. Broth's piece, titled My Front Porch is My Paradise, features Broth's idealized version of home inside a snow globe. I'm stoked to be a part of the Art of Housing event and to help out any way I can, Broth said. It's the things that make a place a home as opposed to just the place you're staying at. There's a feeling of comfort when you're hanging art on the wall. More local artists participating in the event include Steve Bickley, Peter Cochrane, Decane, Hamilton Glass, Emily Herr, Jeremiah Jones, Jerome W. Jones Jr., Nikki Leon, Matt Lively, Silvio Lynch III, Naomi McCavitt, Eli McCullen, Karen Rudman, Noah Scanlon, and Sandy Williams IV. This is the third year for the event. Last year, the Art of Housing raised more than $70,000. This year, organizers say they've already reached that amount thanks to strong sponsor support and ticket sales. The bidding prices for artwork start as low as $25 for Afternoon Together by Elliot Hubbard and up to $1,250 for Witness Kathmandu by Noah Scanlon. The bidding for Broth's My Front Porch is My Paradise starts at $500. Tickets for The Art of Housing and online bidding are available at www.housingfamiliesfirst.org. That story, written by Chelsea Jackson of the Times-Dispatch, was titled Artists Assist Families Facing Homelessness. Emmett?
Thank you, Simon. Our next story, also from page one of today's Richmond Times-Dispatch, involves Browns Island. Upgrade is coming for city venue. Project will cost up to $30 million. This article written by Eric Kalinich of the newspaper. The City of Richmond will partner with nonprofit marketing firm Venture of Richmond to plant trees, install bathrooms, and beautify Browns Island, Mayor LeVar Stoney announced yesterday. The plan, which will cost up to $30 million, is designed to make one of downtown Richmond's biggest attractions better for locals and visitors. The announcement comes as real estate analytics company CoStar continues building a nearby office tower, and construction continues on an outdoor amphitheater, both of which will bring more people to the banks of the James River. The riverfront is going to be a different place in a few years, said Lisa Sims, CEO of Venture Richmond. About 1 million people visit the man-made island each year, which is bound by the James and the Hacksaw Canal. Large events such as the Folk Festival and River Rock are large draws, and locals enjoy its paths, green space, and proximity to the water. Details of the project are undetermined. Venture Richmond released concept images drawn by local architect 3 North, but Lisa Sims, Venture Richmond's CEO, said the images are just suggestions, not formal concept designs. Browns Island is somewhat underwhelming to visitors, Sims said, and the project calls for play areas for kids and opportunities for greater activity. Throughout the island, planners want to add trees to provide more shade. Near the canal, they want to add more art, colorful seating and lighting, and an elevated platform that could be used as an outdoor classroom and a VIP area for concerts. At the T. Tyler Potterfield Bridge, they want to widen the entrance and make it more prominent. The walking bridge, which crosses the James and connects Manchester to Browns Island, attracts 600,000 pedestrians each year. On the south side of the island, they want to terrace the island's edge down to the river, improving visibility and access. Currently, a fence blocks a steep drop-off to the water, and that's covered by trees and brush. The eastern edge of the island, covered by the Manchester Bridge, is often a storage area or backstage area, but planners want to make it more accessible, beautiful, and usable with retrofitted shipping containers to form buildings that could be used in a number of ways, including event space, office space, restrooms, and storage. Planners also want access to drinkable water on the island. Venture Richmond and the city haven't decided if they'll do the work in stages or all at once. If it's done all at once, the work would take 9 months to a year and probably would require closing the island during that time, Sims said. While the general work has already been approved by the city's Urban Design Committee and Planning Commission, the specific projects will need to be approved by City Council. Richmond's elected leaders already adopted the Richmond Riverfront Plan in 2012, which made recommendations for transforming the island into a destination for recreation, for experiencing the beauty of the river, and for enjoying concerts and cultural events. Sims said she'd like to see construction begin by 2026. To fund the project, the city has agreed to contribute $10 million from its capital improvement plan. Venture Richmond plans to raise $10 to $15 million, after which the city will contribute an additional $5 million, resulting in an expected cost of $25 million to $30 million. Across Richmond, city officials are working to improve 28 acres around the James River, including purchasing Mayo Island, adding a park at Dock Street, and building the amphitheater. The James River Park System is the city's central park, Stoney said, and Browns Island is the centerpiece of downtown. Visitors and employees use it every day, and the city should make it a go-to spot. The story from page one of today's Richmond Times-Dispatch. Upgrade is coming for city venue, Browns Island. That project will cost up to $30 million. This article written by Eric Kalinich of the newspaper.
Thank you, Emmett. And the final piece on today's front page is actually a commentary authored by Michael Paul Williams. It's titled, Youth Gun Violence Robs City of Its Future. A Nation at Risk a federal report issued in 1983, became a gospel of education reform. The phrase, at risk, became shorthand for black urban youths in danger of plunging through an increasingly porous safety net. In Richmond, our kids have become appallingly at risk of gun violence. Since Easter, a Christian celebration of resurrection, 8 people have been killed in the city, 4 of them juveniles. This shocking state of affairs is horrifically a trend. 169 young people shot in Richmond since 2019, said Richmond Superintendent Jason Camras. Nearly all of those were RPS students. Camras didn't sign up for this. He's an educator, not a law enforcement officer or an infantry platoon sergeant. But, as the leader of the city's public schools, he has witnessed an unnatural level of youth carnage, as have the district's teachers, administrators, counselors, psychologists, custodians, and other employees. Before free meals became a staple of public education, educators argued convincingly that hunger hinders learning. No less applies to community violence. Our community, our schools, they are hurting, and they should be focused on the SOLs, which we're giving in 2 weeks, Camera said at Monday's City Hall news conference. And instead, many of them this morning and last week and tomorrow are holding grief sessions. Remember that the next time we lament RPS's underperformance on standardized tests, it's hard to see how any vestige of education reform could or would avert these tragedies. These deaths do not come as a result of a mass shooting inside a schoolhouse. They occurred in the community. It's been a terrible 2 weeks in our city, Police Chief Rick Edwards said. Kids have seen their parents killed. Parents have seen their kids killed. Unless people feel safe, snug, and smug in suburbia, Chesterfield and Hanover counties have also experienced deadly teen violence in April. I believe the children are our future, Whitney Houston sang in her 1980s hit, The Greatest Love of All. This violence and our inability to shepherd our kids through adolescence is robbing our city of a piece of its future. The bloodshed has led Edwards to lay down a curfew and start Operation Safe Summer on Friday, nearly 2 months ahead of schedule. But there are no easy answers for a problem that has so many root causes, including trauma's vicious cycle. Last week, Camras attended a standing-room-only funeral for a slain Martin Luther King middle school student. And what struck me is all of the kids from MLK who were able to attend, they all have the T-shirts with a picture of the friend that they lost, he recalled. What is heartbreaking is that so many of our kids have that T-shirt, and many of them have multiple T-shirts. No child should have a T-shirt of a friend that they lost to gun violence, let alone 2 or 3 or 4 of them. Edwards recalled escorting 4 children at a homicide scene at Mosby Court last week. From a 15-year-old down to the 3-year-old, having to see those children crying as they pass their dead parents is heartbreaking for all of us. A 17-year-old male was found with a gunshot wound at the scene. Our criminal justice system, no doubt out of frustration, is targeting parents and educators in response to unfathomable youth violence. Last week, former Richneck Elementary School assistant principal Ebony Parker was charged with felony child neglect, amid allegations that she ignored warnings that a 6-year-old who shot his first-grade teacher had brought a gun to school. The boy's mother, Deja Taylor, was sentenced in December to 2 years in state prison for felony child neglect. She also received 21 months in federal prison on federal gun and marijuana-related charges. Michigan parents James and Jennifer Crumley were convicted earlier this year of involuntary manslaughter for failing to adequately respond to signs of their teenager son's acute mental strife and secure the gun he used in a school shooting that killed 4 students at his high school in 2021. I want every parent to know that has opened up a whole nother level of case law, Mayor LeVar Stoney said of the Michigan case during Monday's news conference. I'm not sure if tough on parents will be any more effective than tough on drugs as a crime prevention measure. These teens hardly need to snatch a parent's peace. There are plenty of firearms to be had illegally on the streets in a nation with the dubious distinction of having more guns than people. We wax nostalgic for the era when the village stepped in to help raise each child. And yes, I am a byproduct of that era, in which every adult in the community felt a sense of responsibility for other people's children. But nowadays, I suspect it's hard enough for parents to keep track of their own kids, especially in communities with a paucity of two-parent households. Government tries to fill the void, but it's a poor substitute for a parent. There's no dollar that can fill in every single gap, Stoney said. There's no employee on the city payroll that can fill in every single gap. And that's why we are here collectively pleading with our neighborhoods, which back in the day used to raise our kids as well. That village, nowadays, has been gutted by an information superhighway and buffeted by the noxious effects of social media and the easy availability of firearms, a match-diffused combination for the young mind. Edwards recalls the 1990s, when the motives for violence were turf, drugs, and robbery. As bad as those are, at least that makes more sense, he said. Nowadays, small arguments escalate. Everyone in the war of words is armed. One bullet fired leads to many. When folks long for the good old days of a fistfight, or look at Richmond's triple-digit homicide era of the 1990s as a time of relative sanity, you know we've reached a point of deep despair and desperation. Our region is not alone. Since 2020, firearms have been the number one cause of death among children and teens in the U.S., according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. When energy we could exert to educate our kids is being expended to keep them alive, we're a nation at risk, for sure. That commentary by Michael Paul Williams came from the bottom of today's front page and was titled, Youth Gun Violence Robs City of Its Future.